It's Wednesday, December 3rd, 2014, and this is KBIA's Views of the News. Our weekly roundtable on media behaviors comes to you from the Futures Lab studio at the Reynolds Journalism Institute. I'm Amy Simons, and here with me are my Missouri School of Journalism colleagues Mike McKean and Ernest Perry. On our program this week, our reaction to the coverage coming out of Ferguson during and since the announcement that Darren Wilson wouldn't face indictment. Ray Rice's wife tells her story to ESPN and NBC after a judge grants her husband's appeal, ordering him eligible to play NFL football once again. And why some think Sony Pictures was hacked by North Korea. We've got a lot more for you as well. Hopefully we'll be able to get it all in before our half hour is up. But we were off last week for the Thanksgiving holiday, so this is the first time the three of us have had a chance to sit around this table and talk since the St. Louis County Prosecutor Robert McCullough announced that the grand jury had decided not to indict Darren Wilson. We had talked previously about the latitudes given to police officers when on the job and how hard it was going to be to get an indictment. So that part may not have been a huge surprise to the two of you. I don't think it was to me. But other parts of how things unfolded, either leading up to that announcement Monday or since that point?
Well, I was actually, I wasn't really surprised by the way the announcement was presented by McCullough. He spent the first part of it basically talking about process and then, you know, blaming the media for a lot of things that were coming out and reaction to it and that sort of thing.
Fair criticism?
No, I don't think it was fair criticism, not by his office. Anyway, I mean, there are other there are other people who could have made criticisms. I don't think he should have been making a criticism. I mean, his responsibility was to basically give the announcement of what the grand jury decided to do and then leave it at that. For him to come out and criticize the media was sort of trying to deflect the blame on his office and others before the announcement came out. So I don't think he should have been making any kind of criticisms.
I mean, in terms of McCullough, one thing he did surprise me with is deciding to announce it when he did at 8:30 at night after all the advice from law enforcement and others that they'd received not to do it then. I mean, that was surprising to me. It wasn't really surprising to me that he knocked the media, although I think if he wanted to do that, and he made a few valid points. He really should have put that at the end rather than this long prelude and excuse making.
It was about 9.5 minutes
the way he had set it up as if, you know, these are the excuses as to why this is going to happen or that did happen, as opposed to just, you know, putting it at the end like you're saying.
He should have laid out the evidence as he saw it from the grand jury and announced what the grand jury had decided. Then if he wants to get into all of that in a Q&A with the reporters or whatever, that's fine. I do think that it was pretty clear that he made it clear which witnesses he believed and which ones he didn't, not just that he thought that some witnesses lined up better with the other evidence. And so I'm not sure that was a smart thing for him to do either.
I do want to commend him and others for at least releasing all of the grand jury information. That's unusual. That doesn't usually happen. They said they're going to do it. They lived up to that promise, so people can make the decision on their own as to what they thought about the evidence. So it was all laid out
there. I agree, but I also think it's sort of the least he could do. I mean, if he's going to criticize the media, the news media especially, for disseminating undocumented rumors or unproven facts or whatever, what does he expect when the media are supposed to sit around for 3 months and wait for a grand jury to come out with its version of what the truth was?
That's my big criticism of him, is that in and of itself, is that would you expect the media not to do this? They do it all the time. They do it on cases that are even more low profile than this one. So why would you expect it to be any different?
Taking it back to the media coverage of what went on, any examples you would want to point out, either wins, hits, misses, things that we should be proud of as a profession, things that we would look at and kind of want to back away from?
Well, I think part of it, I mean, it just seemed like, you know, the media was geared up for whatever kind of violence that was going to take place. Yes, they did talk about some of the peaceful things that everyone was trying to set up. Who was involved in Ferguson and getting ready for the announcement. They did all those stories. But as soon as the announcement came out, a lot of the media went straight toward the rioting and the fires and that sort of thing. Not that I didn't expect him to do that, but after a while, it was sort of like, okay, we've seen this before. Give us something else in terms of where is this going to go.
And some of that criticism we've had in the past of how much of that ended up happening because there were cameras that were pointed at it. And for as long as that attention continues, as will the action.
I would just turn that criticism just a little bit. I mean, I think that it's true that the media did, as a group, tended to focus on a lot of those things like the rioting and the fires and such. It is part of the story. The bigger problem is that there were other stories. There was more context, but it was so overwhelmed, one, by the other media coverage, and two, by audience expectations. I mean, I think audiences have to be smarter about how they consume content if they don't want to be fooled by it or if they don't want to just see the emotional aspects of the news stories. They have to be smart news consumers as well.
No, I agree with you on that point. There were some really good stories. I mean, there were some really pointed questions at Governor Jay Nixon and all the things that he said that he was going to do or that they were planning to do in terms of protecting lives, protecting property, and that sort of thing. You didn't see that once that announcement came out. I mean, there was a lot of property damage that he said the National Guard and others were there to protect that didn't take place. And there was some media that called him out on that after this happened.
I will say, too, that if I want to hold up some coverage for praise, I would say it was the local coverage from the Post-Dispatch and St. Louis Public Radio. I thought they did a good job of providing some in-depth interviews. And the Post-Dispatch actually reported some things that nobody else did. I mean, I, for example, saw a piece on the weekend about this group called Oath Keepers, this sort of shadowy group coming around from around the country and on the rooftops of businesses trying to protect them. Where else did that story come from? I also saw in the Post-Dispatch a story about Darren Wilson resigning from the force, but it also said his wife, who is also a cop on the force, was asked to resign but did not, at least not yet. And so there were little bits of the local coverage that added some context and flavor that I really appreciated.
More nuanced. Well, comedian Chris Rock is on a publicity tour promoting his new film, Top Five, and he's been asked a lot for his reactions to what's gone on in Ferguson and about racism. Here's part of the discussion he had with Mo Rocca on the magazine program, CBS Sunday Morning.
Do you think that people are too careful when they talk about race?
It's not that I think that people are too careful when they talk about race. I think people in general are just too quick to call things racist. Sometimes people say things that are racist are just out of not knowing any better. And once they know better, they're like, oh, I'm sorry, I didn't know that offended you like that.
And you think that sometimes behavior like that is branded as racist?
Racist or homophobic or, you know, anti-Semitic or whatever, just people not knowing.
And that sometimes bottles them up and then they don't.
Of course that bottles them up or makes them actually become racist. Mm-hmm. Because they get like, hey, I was just asking a question and I got beat up by all these people.
Chris Rock said in part of that interview that his dream job would be to become a correspondent for 60 Minutes and that he would want to do a lot of in-depth reporting on race. And had he had the opportunity to go to Ferguson, he'd want to interview all Caucasian people.
Well, I mean, that's what I would have liked to have seen. I mean, go out and ask them questions. And that was done by a lot of news outlets. There were news outlets that went to Ferguson and talked to the white residents who live in Ferguson and get their opinions about what was going on and how it was going to impact. So that was being done. But the one thing I liked about there was a longer piece that was done by Frank Rich
in
the New York Magazine with Chris Rock, where he talked about racism being a issue for whites as opposed to blacks, and the fact that we need to have more reporting done about how whites feel about these things as opposed to when the issues of race, Ferguson, Trayvon Martin, you can go on, we usually go to blacks. Well, most of the time we know what those answers are going to be. It's going to the other side that he was bringing out, we need to talk about. And that racism is not just a black problem, it's a white problem.
Well, and one of the things that Chris Rock had said in there was that some of the progress we've seen as a country is because whites are, in his words, less crazy than they used to be. The Washington Post's Wonk blog went and actually did some statistical analysis of that, also available on the Links blog at KBIA.org. And kind of showed that maybe there's some truth behind it.
No, I think it's pretty hard to argue with that statement that anybody who's talking about black progress is making the wrong argument. It's about whites are making progress and that they're a little less crazy about race than they used to be. I think that's probably true. And it's interesting to me, you look at this story, you look at the Bill Cosby story, you know, now with comedians coming out and basically breaking the story wide open. We've praised Jon Stewart and Stephen Colbert over the years for what they've done. What is it about comedians and getting to the heart of stories that journalists aren't getting to the heart
of? Well, I think that they can use humor to tell us things that we already know.
And it's easier for an audience to reach it. Exactly. It's more accessible, more approachable.
Yeah, exactly. I think that's basically what's happening with these conversations. But one of the things that I think the point that he gets to is that we talk about race all the time. And in fact, since Obama was elected president, we've literally been having a conversation on race for the last 6 years. It's just that we've been sort of talking at each other and not talking to each other. And we've been talking around all these incidents that have come up. We've mentioned them all. We've talked about them all. But when you sit down and you read the interview that Frank Rich had with Chris Rock, you get a sense as to where that conversation is right now.
Well, on Friday, former Baltimore Ravens player Ray Rice won his appeal. A judge ruled the NFL's indefinite suspension against him be vacated. The Ravens cut Rice, and the NFL suspended him after a video of an altercation between Rice and his then-fiancée, Janae, became public. Well, after that suspension was lifted, ESPN released an essay. It's an in-her-own-words type of a description of what happened, as it had been told to reporter Jemele Hill. That interview happened on November 5th, and it was published with an editor's note that indicated that while there were no questions off limits, ESPN did give final control over the essay and its publication date to Janae Hill. Janae Rice. ESPN's Jemele Hill appeared on CNN's Reliable Sources Sunday and had this to say about that agreement.
There have been other As Told To stories, and a lot of them take this format, and I know the way it sounds, and I know the way it sounds for me. Again, by trade, I'm a journalist, and so I know people see that language of final approval, and they envision this process of her shooting down things not to be in there, but it was in no way was this ever a dictatorship. It was fully a collaboration. She came into it with the mindset that she wanted to be as transparent as possible, and as for the release date, the interview took place during the appeals process, and it just made more sense to not publish the story until after that process had been completed. I mean, I spoke to her moments after the NFL or the arbitrator decided to reinstate Ray Rice, because that was something, a reaction we wanted included in the piece or something.
Right.
And it was stuff that I wanted to have. So when I did speak about her in the piece, I can say, oh, I spoke to her and this was her reaction to the appeals process.
So it is a very compelling read, and it's one that people are going to be interested in, football fans, non-football fans alike. But do you think that maybe ESPN went too far giving Rice that much control over it?
I mean, I don't. I mean, frankly, there's only one question that ESPN hasn't answered to anybody's satisfaction yet, and that's, was there any content, any question that was asked that Janae Rice said, no, you can't print the answer to that? We don't know. But otherwise, they were totally transparent about it. And if Ray or Janae Rice think that they somehow were going to control their message because of this control they had over one piece in ESPN, then they don't know very much about the little drop in the bucket that was in this huge tsunami of coverage that was going to come after it. So I don't have a problem with it.
You know, it may be one of those things where they thought going into it that they were going to be able to control the message. But I think that what happens, especially if you go back and you look at the whole piece in which Jemele Hill is explaining what happened, what you see is that she went in and educated them about, here's what's going to happen. We can do it this way, and you can have somewhat of a control, but this is a collaboration. This is not just all about you. And you need to understand that this story is already out there, and there are others who are controlling the narrative. What we're going to do is get another piece of that narrative in which you are able to talk, but this is a collaboration, not you being in total control.
I also thought it was really interesting to look at the other piece of the story that the Today Show aired, their exclusive video interview with Janae Rice and later with Ray Rice, who showed up apparently after they finished the one. And boy, what really stood out for me was, if anything else, the news that came out of this whole thing was the Baltimore Ravens managed that news conference and basically insisted that she apologize for her part in the situation. It wasn't her idea to do that.
I mean, one of the things that we're starting to find out from this is that there were certain things that the NFL was trying to do before the suspension to try to calm the waters or quell the story. Mm-hmm. And now you're starting to hear that what the commissioner did or didn't do, how he backtracked on certain things. And I think that had a lot to do with what eventually happened in terms of the arbitrator siding with Ray Rice, is that, wait a minute, you know, you can't have it both ways. You can't give him a 2-game suspension and he does all the things that you ask him to do and then completely suspend him indefinitely. I mean, that's just one of those things. And I know that there are going to be people out there who are going to say, but what he did was heinous. And I agree with that. But the rules say one thing. And if you follow the letter of the law as stipulated by the NFL and the Players Association, then you're going to have to follow that.
Okay. Well, this next topic might seem a little bit inside baseball to some of our listeners, but it caught my eye. Rudy Keller had a piece in the Columbia Daily Tribune on Friday that reported most of the journalists covering state government in Jefferson City are going to have to move. Senate staff will be taking over the state-supplied workspace now used by 9 of the 10 publications with a presence at the Capitol. The reporters will be moved from a first-floor workspace to a room in the basement. The only group that's not being moved, the Missouri School of Journalism's Bureau, which is under the control, the space that it works in is under the control of the State House. This is all the result of some renovations that are being done at the Capitol. So it's a temporary change, sort of.
Yeah, and I get the complaint. I understand that for a while, these journalists are going to be working in cramped circumstances, and mm-hmm. the broadcast journalists may have a real difficult time. I understand the complaint that it, you know, kind of took the media by surprise. But I also have to say that there's a bigger context here. Last night, I was down at the state capitol because there was an event honoring Bob Priddy, who after 40 years as the news director of the Missouri Net is retiring, gave me my first paying job. And, you know, he made a point that we've made on this show a lot. And that's the fact that a lot of news organizations have pulled back their coverage of state government, right? There aren't as many news organizations with full-time correspondents down there in Jefferson City or in state capitals around the country anymore. Well, if news organizations are devaluing the coverage of state government, then why wouldn't the politicians who control the resources down there for the media or their own staffs devalue the media to a certain extent? I think part of it is our own problem coming home to roost.
I mean, I agree with Mike. I mean, it's one of those things where when it's someone else basically taking something away from the media, then we want to howl at the moon and get all upset. But we brought a lot of this on ourselves because we aren't covering state government the way we should. And what happens is we're there during the legislative session and then we're gone after that. And they're saying, okay, we're going to give you some quarters, but it's not going to be up in the penthouse anymore. You're going to have to go down into the basement. We're not saying you can't do it. We're just not going to provide you with lofty accommodations.
And I have to say, I don't want to just blame the media. I think that, frankly, the public takes some blame in this as well. One of the other points that Bob Priddy was making last night is that he can remember a time not that long ago when Republicans and Democrats and the media all took a longer view. There weren't term limits. There were journalists who were there for a long time covering it. There was institutional memory. There was a focus on compromise for the greater good in the long term. None of that exists anymore. The media are partly culpable in that, but politicians and the voters are equally culpable.
Well, I think you've got to a point now, and this is politics almost nationwide, where it's not about governing, it's about campaigning and it's about politicking, and it's that all the time. So when people think about government, they aren't thinking about the compromise, the legislation, and that sort of thing. They're thinking about wins and losses, Republicans and Democrats, and that sort of thing. And that's what become of governing in our country.
Podcasting. It's nothing new. It's been around for more than a decade. This show is available via podcast, as is most of KBIA's programming. But the medium has seen a huge resurgence as of late. Maybe you've been listening to Serial, the murder mystery told by Sarah Koenig. Now in week 10, it's the fastest growing podcast in history, with subscribers waiting impatiently for the next installment to drop every Thursday morning. What is it about podcasting right now that it's making this splash?
Well, I mean, first of all, you have a podcast that's really resonating with people. I listen to Serial. I mean, I can't wait for tomorrow's episode to come down.
Don't tell me yet, because I'm a few weeks behind. I have them. I have them queued up.
So, I mean, there's good content there, but there's a lot of other structural things that are also changing the public's interest in podcasting. First of all, the economy's gotten better, so advertisers are more willing to pay. People are willing to provide crowdfunding to help support podcasts like Serial. You also have the fact, though, that now people can get these podcasts very easily on their smartphones. Mm-hmm. They can have them in their cars, and because of Bluetooth, they can listen to these things in places where they normally would be, quote, forced, unquote, to listen to regular radio. So I think there's lots of reasons why it's suddenly taken off.
I think it is the technology. I think the convenience of it. I mean, you can listen to it at any time at your own choosing, and you're not having to be stuck to some sort of schedule. And this goes back to the whole Hulu, Netflix, and that sort of thing. This is just an extension of that, and I think that's why this is taken off.
So is it a threat to terrestrial radio, then?
Oh, I think it is, actually. And part of it is because these podcasts, especially these ones that are fronted by, you know, a personality that people really enjoy, they seem more authentic than just more run-of-the-mill content from some big media conglomerate. Even though, I mean, frankly, 7 of the 10 top 10 podcasts are from public media. These are big conglomerate media organizations, but they feel more authentic. And I think people find that really interesting.
I mean, I think it's that the professional way in which they're done. I mean, the early podcasts was sort of like, you know, you're listening and it's sort of like somebody's in a hollow room and it's hard to really understand what's going on.
The cable access that we saw in the 80s, exactly. Wayne's World, becomes audio only.
Right, exactly. And now you're seeing a much more professional kind of a product, and I think that resonates with fans as well.
But I will say, you asked the question, does terrestrial radio have to worry? They do, because it is so convenient, and especially now that it's going to be easier and easier to have internet access at all times in your car where people listen to terrestrial radio. It's going to be trouble if they don't figure out how to create this kind of compelling niche content for listeners.
So holiday weekends, they're pretty big for movies. So when word came out on Friday that a hack of Sony Pictures' computer systems resulted in the leaking of at least 4, maybe 5 unreleased films, it caught people's attention. According to a report published online on Friday on the site Recode, Sony is looking into the possibility that the hackers could be working on behalf of the North Korean government. That's because of the timing of the attack. See, because it's just before the release of the film The Interview. It's a comedy that stars Seth Rogen and James Franco as celebrity journalists who are recruited by the CIA to assassinate North Korean leader Kim Jong-un. If this is the North Koreans, how do they think it happened?
I guess the way hacking has been going on for as long as we've known about it. I mean, they figured out a way to get into Sony's computer system and wreak havoc. And that's basically what's happening.
Well, about North Korea being necessarily this big technical powerhouse.
They say the Chinese were probably helping them. And we know the Chinese
government and military
are very good at hacking computers. You know, the thing of it is, this isn't just a kind of a funny story
payback for a movie. It's not a funny story at all.
Because you know what they were able to do? They were able to lock down this entire operation. And if they can do it to a movie studio, they can do it to a public utility or
and it's the information they were able to access. You're talking about employee records. You're talking about Social Security numbers. I mean, they actually got in and were looking, had access to their HR records.
They took over control of the computers, not just pulling out resources.
Well, and some of the stories that have come out as a result of this, I saw a story go by quickly that I didn't have a whole lot of time to read this morning, that there's now some of this data that's been released is showing that there are women working at Sony making $800,000 less than men in the same jobs. Stuff that we probably knew was going on, but without access to this information in a private company,
and if
it
this
never
information,
would have really seen the light of
day.
If this
information gets out, it's not only embarrassing to Sony, but it also hurts them in a huge business aspect, because now you have other companies that can use that information against them.
It's an interesting thing to watch and to see how it develops. How might other media companies find themselves vulnerable?
Well, they are vulnerable. And in fact, one of the things that you will hear companies talking about a lot behind the scenes is this whole problem of data security.
Yeah.
I mean, news organizations really care about this because, as we've seen in the past, news organizations can be brought down or content can be spoofed on their site that looks real that isn't real. So, I mean, it is a serious problem.
And I think this is something that I know the Washington Post and the New York Times and their recent upgrades of their websites have, and a lot of it has been on the security side more so than the content side.
Well, before we go, there is one other movie I want to ask the two of you about. It's The Imitation Game. I was thinking I really wanted to go see it, but there's a line in the New York Times review that now has me thinking twice. Did you know there's math involved? I mean, advanced math.
I'm just a mathematician.
Sometimes it is the people who no one imagines anything of who do the things that no one can imagine.
The New York Times is worried, too. Its review warns that the film carries a PG-13 rating for illicit sex, cataclysmic violence, and advanced math, most of it mentioned rather than shown. It's no secret. I'm terrible at math. Please don't make me do it.
Well, it's just one of those things when we say a journalist doing math is a dangerous thing.
It sure is.
But I do find it funny for them to play off of that. But part of it, too, is that, you know, we have this sort of thing about there are only certain people who really, really understand math. And I'm going to be interested to see just how much math they put into this movie and whether or not it's going to add to the conversation or take away from the movie.
As unfunny as our last topic was about North Korea and hacking in movies, this one is funny.
It is funny, and I hope that if that's a way to get people in to see the movie, I hope they do, because the movie is pretty serious, too. I mean, it is about Alan Turing and about the code breakers in World War II. And frankly, it's not just about their exploits and the fact that Turing essentially was one of the early pioneers of what has become the computing world and the internet that we know of today, but also he was a hero at one moment, and very quickly, because of his sexual preference, his sexual orientation, he was brought down. So there's a lot of lessons in that movie besides whether or not journalists can do math.
Well, the thing about it is this movie and the movie Unbroken, I mean, you're starting to see a lot of movies about World War II that tell another side of the story that we really haven't seen. It's what happens behind the scenes of warfare.
Not just movies. The series that was on WGN America, Manhattan, if you haven't had a chance to see any of that, taking a look at the Manhattan Project, one that I know I enjoyed this late summer, early fall. Well, we're just about out of time for today's program. I'd like to thank you for joining us this week. We've had a great discussion this half hour. You can read more about the topics we talked about and one or two we didn't quite get to. To find that information, check out our links blog. It's under the programs tab at kbia.org. We encourage you to like us on Facebook or follow us on Twitter. Our handle is @viewsonkbia. These are all great ways to watch and listen to our program again, leave us comments or questions, see previews of what we'll be talking about next week, and more. Our thanks to our technical team, Travis McMillan, Pat Akers, and Maya Jackson, and to associate producers Kendrisa Cockrell and Hope Kerwin. I'm Amy Simons. Be sure to join us again next week when we're back with you for another edition of Views of the News.